So welcome everybody to a very special occasion. My name is Stephen Hertenstein and I'm director of Anchor Publishing. And the book presentation today is being held in conjunction with MIAS, the Ibn Arabi Society. And special thanks go to Chris Ramland for her help in organizing this, and also to the University of Frankfurt, who are hosting this session. We'll be focusing on the most recent book that Anchor Publishing has published, which I guess you've all seen in the waiting room. And I'm really pleased to see so many people attending, because perhaps it's testimony to the subject matter that we're going to discuss today, the importance of it, as well as the standing of the author. So let me just quickly explain the format for today's presentation, because it'll be a little bit different to what we've done before. I'm going to give a brief introduction to the book and the author, and then I'll be discussing the book with Professor Pablo Benito. And after we've had a bit of a discussion, then I'm going to ask Professor Michael Sells to join us and to give his own appraisal of the book. And after all of that's done, then we'll open the floor to questions. And so without further ado, it's my great pleasure and honor to introduce my friend, colleague, collaborator, Professor Pablo Benito, who is well known to all of you, I would think, as one of the main Western researchers into Ibn Arabi in our time. And he is fortunate enough to live in Ibn Arabi's birthplace, in the town of Murcia in southeastern Spain. So perhaps something of the Sheikh is present and remains in the earth that Pablo walks on every day and the air he breathes. His day job is as professor in the Department of Translation and Interpreting at the University of Murcia, but his night and day passion is for Ibn Arabi's teachings, about which he has written a great deal, including articles in the Journal of the Mujahideen Ibn Arabi Society, one or two of which you will perhaps know as being on the subject of the names. He is also president and founder of MIAS Latina, a kind of sister organization to the Mujahideen Ibn Arabi Society here in the UK, and editor and founder of El Azufre Rojo, the Spanish journal which is dedicated to Ibn Arabi's teachings and is publishing excellent editions and studies of Ibn Arabi's works in Spanish and other Latin languages. But today, we're here to discuss his latest book, the English translation of his edition and translation of one of Ibn Arabi's shorter treatises, called in Arabic Kashf al-Ma'ana and Sir Asma Allah al-Husna, to give it its full title. It was originally published in Murcia 28 years ago, and it looks like this. It's a small volume, apparently, but very thick, and had the first Arabic edition, proper critical edition of the text. And it's now available, as I've said, as The Secret of God's Most Beautiful Names. As it's a long title in both Arabic and English, I shall refer to it simply as the Kashf al-Ma'ana, or just Kashf. But we've got two texts in this book, which I'll explain in a minute. So we're going to have a very deep dive into one of the most fascinating topics in Islam generally, and in Ibn Arabi's writings in particular. And as it says on the back of the book, the naming of God is one of the essential pillars of the monotheistic traditions. And every name of God has its own presence. According to the greatest spiritual master, Ibn Arabi, the 99 names of God in Islamic devotional practice and spiritual teaching are the fundamental way of expressing the full relationship between the human being and the divine, between unity and multiplicity, and between transcendence and immanence. The Secret of God's Most Beautiful Names presents, for the first time in English, two of the most profound teachings on the 99 names. Ibn Arabi's Kashf al-Ma'na, depicting each of the names according to three complementary perspectives, and the summary, drawn from his Futuhat al-Makkiyah. And the book also contains not only the translations of these texts, but also the Arabic edition of both of them, as well as a very helpful introduction on the meaning of the divine names and so on. And then an appendix where he talks about, Pablo talks about the manuscripts and the dating of the text and so on, and the ordering of the names. So that, to give you a brief introduction, as I've mentioned, this is an English translation of an Arabic text that you, Pablo, first edited and translated into Spanish. Can you tell us a little bit about how the book came about originally? I believe it was the first major encounter you had with Ibn Arabi's teachings. So what made you focus on this topic in particular?
Hello, everybody. And yes, effectively, Stephen, it was my first approach to deeply read and persist in one of Ibn Arabi's texts. It was the subject I chose for my doctoral thesis at the Complutense in Madrid. So it was a whole process of research and getting familiar with Ibn Arabi at the same time. Why to choose the topic of the names? First of all, because of its relevance to Islamic tradition and Sufism in particular. And then because I thought, well, by studying such a wide subject connected to most main subjects of the human reality, I can always focus in the Jamal, in aesthetics, in justice, in this. So I thought it was the door to a number of possible paths. And yes, it was like that. It became a whole horizon of possibilities for further research.
And I believe you had a little bit of difficulty in getting yourself accepted to do a PhD on the divine names of Ibn Arabi.
Okay, I see you are pointing to something more intimate. Yes, indeed. Indeed, I wanted to do these studies, and my professors, who were very capable, on the other hand, they refused because they said, well, this is beyond our scope. I'm not a specialist in Ibn Arabi. Even a great scholar such as Federico Corriente, for example, who was very close to me, he would say, well, I can work with you in this domain of literature or whatever, but Ibn Arabi is too... is beyond my capability. Of course, he himself did some publications, wonderful publications on Ibn Arabi, but that was the situation. So it's true that I didn't manage to find a proper director in my surroundings, but it was by chance, and I guess you are alluding to that, you already know, is that I entered a room and I saw one of those big professors, Maria Jesus Viguera, discussing with somebody the direction of a thesis on the divine names in Imbarajan, and immediately it came out of my mouth. So let's do the same with Ibn Arabi, so that we can be in working together on the matter. And so she finally accepted because of this immediacy, this sudden inspiration through the situation. So yes, interesting. So in a way, it appeared as a providential casual fact like that. Then it was connected, as I say, to the intention of working in this multiplicity of aspects towards the understanding of unity.
So let's talk about the book a little bit more in detail. The title of the book is very intriguing. And as you observe in your introduction to the book, Ibn Arabi chooses precise, meaningful titles that offer the reader essential information regarding the content and intention of the work. Can you say something more about this particular Arabic title of the Kashf al-Ma'na and the English title, because they're not quite the same, and how they've come about like that?
Well, do you mean the English title specifically, or you mean the meaning of the Arabic title?
Let's start with the meaning of the Arabic title.
Yes. In fact, the English edition is more complete in some respects, because some aspects, for example, in the approach to understand the details, the subtleties of the title, are in the English edition and they are not present in the Spanish one, because at the time I was, for example, not as conscious of the Abjad, the alphanumerical Abjad system implications of Ibn Arabi's language in his speech. For example, now we can see that the Western value of the terms of the title, if we count all letters, comes precisely to be 100. So, which is referring to the hadith of that the names are 100 minus 1, so 99, and so referring to the structure of the book itself. And other interesting correspondences happen if we count in the other alternative Oriental Eastern system, right? So, for example, this is one dimension we could approach the title where also this hidden dimension of meaning is very relevant. But let's say that in Ibn Arabi's titles, every term really introduces us to the way in which we should approach the text. So starting by Kashf al-Ma'ana is not just a rhetorical expression, and to have two parts of a title rhyming or something is really very significant, because he is letting us know that we are in front of a text that is coming out of the experience of Kashf. So it's a text of unveiling. And we see that through all the text, because the author is extremely original, as he always is, but it's not a book of, let's say, erudition. It eventually quotes a lot of poetry, of traditional poetry, and of course has implicitly a lot of the intellectual background and questions and relevant questions of the tradition. But it's a very fresh book in the sense that it's really coming from the personal experience and understanding through this unveiling experience of the author. So that's highly significant. And then also we can see, for example, when we realize he says the unveiling, so retiring the veil, the unveiling of the meaning is a movement of retiring a veil, so it's of direct vision, right? And this direct vision is of the secret. And we observe that he's using singulars, for example. So he's particularly talking of a secret that is contained in the whole book, in the multiplicity of chapters related to the names. There is one secret that is being dealt with all through. And we see that the question is the meaning. So he's not using Ma'ani as we would see in the treatise on the names by Ghazali or the one by Razi. He's specifically using singulars, and this is also very meaningful. So he would provide, in every word of the title, he's providing us with keys to read from a certain perspective. So certainly to make the title more available, more immediately acceptable for a common reader in Spanish or English, it's better to reduce it and say, talk about the secret of the names, right, as we did. But this part, the unveiling of the secret, of the meaning on the secret, is very significant indeed, yes. I could develop more, of course, the idea of secret, but let's leave it for a reading.
We'll come to the word secret in a minute. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the idea of the 99 names, 99 most beautiful names, because you cite the famous hadith, which you just mentioned, that Allah or God has 99 names, 100 minus one. And if a person keeps count or takes account of them, he will enter the garden or paradise. I believe that in the Kashf al-Ma'ana, Ibn Arabi is using a traditional list of names, divine names, as used by Ghazali, his predecessor. But his approach is quite different. And you say his commentaries are original and don't follow any of his predecessors. Can you say something more about the originality and especially the three approaches that he's taking to the names in the Kashf?
Well, yes, as I realized from the very beginning, because it was my task was easier because of a very impressive study done by Daniel G. Marais, Le Nom Divin en Islam, so where he studied a lot of writings on the names before and after Ibn Arabi. And so it was in order to see how those commentaries were organized, I realized that including the Sufi commentaries by Ghazali or others, no one did use this kind of triple perspective that Ibn Arabi systematically uses to approach each of the 99 names, so that they could be, the chapters could be multiplied by three, right? Those three, for example, in some commentaries, we would see just an approach to what Ibn Arabi calls ta'alluq, which is the first section, the first perspective of every name. This comes from the root of alaq, of alaqa, relationship, a relation. So it's a kind of connection of something to something. In Ibn Arabi's understanding, this perspective would be connected to the iftiqar, to the need, to the poverty, to the indigence, the need the human being have toward this particular attribute of God, establishing a relationship of demand. So the ta'alluq expresses the perspective from which the person is asking God for something related to that, to the effects and properties of that name. So some, this would be, for example, connected to those writings of the Sufi writers, as for example, the Dua of Ibn Abbad Ar-Rundi, where people are doing prayers specifically to ask God through his attributes. So this would be connected to a consciousness, to a consciousness of this dependence, as finally it is translated into English. We could have said relation, but it's a bit vague. It would have rhyme with realization and characterization, but it's a little bit vague. So, but the idea is this idea of relation of need. And so in those writings that are a kind of dua, that would be the case. That would be a similar expression. Then we have this second aspect, which is the tahakkuk, the root of this fifth form of the masdar, of the verbal noun, is connected to the haq, right? It's the root of haq. And the next term, which is tahalluq, is of the root of khalq. So this pair of terms, haq, khalq, always referring in Ibn Arabi to the relationship of God as the real and human being as the creation par excellence. No, the final creation or the creation, which is the synthesis of all creation. So let's say that the second level refers to the realization of the meaning in terms of what a name means as referring related to God himself. And here we can see like two levels. One level is an approach, an intelligible approach of understanding, of grasping all the meanings, the possible meanings of that name in terms of the divine. But the other final tahakkuk would refer to the experience of theosis, thus the process by which the in a sort of ta'alluh, of divinization, no, the human being would, through the fana, through the extinction, would disappear in terms of individual consciousness to be inverse as a consciousness of unity. And from this perception, it's like God realizing himself, the meaning of his name, receiving his own consciousness of the meaning. So this is the higher level, let's say, among the three. Finally, and ultimately, in another sense, we have the tahalluq related to the creature. So it has been translated as characterization, because it also refers to the character, to the divine characters, al-akhlaq originally, but also to the human nature as a character. And so through here, we see that Ibn Arabi is approaching the idea of how human being has been taught, as the Quran say, Adam was taught all the names. So the question here is that the human being may restore his theomorphic original nature by being characterized by all those names in the way that is proper to his condition. And so this is also make us think of this Quranic term, you know, that everything has been created through the haq. And so in a sense, in this realization at the level of being characterized, the haq is being manifest through human being and will be known through the pupil of his eye that the human being is in symbolical terms Ibn Arabi often uses. So that's a possible approach. Now, most treatises that deal with more than one aspect, as for example Ghazali, would mix or sometimes separate the a treatment of the names similar to Tahakkuk and Tahalluk, but not always, and I don't know of any treatise that would clearly separate those three levels and articulate them in such an in such a way. So I would say that also stylistically is a very original work, but I was trying to find echoes of the way Ibn Arabi writes about the names in all the previous works, and it was almost in vain. If you compare to Ghazali's Mahsa al-Mahsad al-Asna, sometimes you have resonances, you have similar terms, because tradition, of course, offers the same terms of references, of reference, but basically it's a very, very original technical text on the names. I think it's very useful for a person who aims to get deep into the matter, because it's a very useful tool for, let's say, meditation. You want to understand a name, so you go there, you face, okay, he's saying that in terms of my need towards a particular attribute of the real. And then you can stop there and meditate on that level, and you can go to another level, etc. So it's synthetic, systematic, and always inspiring, and without losing the perspective of being very technical in terms of linguistical references and so, is also very penetrating in terms of providing inspiring motives for a deeper understanding. And always related to experience, right? This idea that the title goes for Kashf is connected to the fact that what is demanded of the reader as well is that you stop mechanical thinking, and then you read from another place of let's say contemplation. It's a matter. This book, I would say, is a book to be taken from that presence of contemplation. Now, this motif in the book, I discuss a possible precedent, but it's not completely clear. The structure in these three aspects could be inspired by an aphorism attributed to Abu Madian Shu'aib, the famous Andalusian North African Sufi master, whom Ibn Arabi had in high esteem, as is well known. But it's not completely clear that that was the case, so I leave it like that. Anyway, I have not found any other previous inspiration that would explain this pattern. Very significant, this triadic approach that is so relevant, so important for Ibn Arabi, considering, as he does, that three would be the first number. It's the first, the triangle that is the expression of a number in a space as a triangular form. And for him, it's the beginning of the series of numbers properly, in a sense, and is any process of knowing, of experiencing, of loving, of manifesting implies a triad. So it's very logical, let's say, that he approach a name from this triadic perspective.
It's interesting what you're saying about the kind of structure of the book, which is quite particular and systematic on one side, and on the other side, the idea of kashf, of unveiling, and of contemplative progression, which you pointed out. It's a juxtaposition between those two, because it can often seem we ought to be talking about poetic explanation, if you see what I mean. You know, it's a very, in one respect, kashf is to do with a kind of poetic expression. And here we have a very systematic, ordered, integral way of looking at the names. Can I just pick up something that you've touched on and maybe you can say a bit more about? Understanding the divine names is a contemplative practice in one respect. But he also mentions, Ibn Arabi, that the names that we know are actually just the names of the names of the primordial names. Can you explain a little bit about what he means by that?
Indeed, and thank you for that question, because I think it's a very relevant topic of the book, especially particularly in the introduction, in the Muqaddimah, but not just. And it is a subject that appears also in some very important poems he did and in some parts of his other works. But he calls those names the primordial names, al-asma al-qadima. And he says something very important that is connected, in fact, to the hadith you were referring to the idea of whoever counts, takes into account those names will enter the garden. We should keep in mind that the garden is also the veil, because Ibn Arabi do not aim for the garden as a final aim, because it would be the veil of the divine face. So in that sense, he wants to go further. And so taking into account this counting that is qualitative, obviously, no? If you are able to enumerate qualitatively, to realize, in fact, to actualize the meaning of all those names in your heart, then you enter the garden of the nature of the human veil itself. Well, this is a complex thing. Anyway, let's focus on the idea of ihsa, on this taking into account. What is being counted, enumerated here, are those names of the 99 list, of the list of 99 names, or is the hadith referring to those primordial names? That's a big question. Anyway, let's go, and what a beautiful idea this minus one, because it's like the subtraction of the principle of oneness is necessary for the manifestation of full multiplicity of the 99, so that they come back by the addition of the one, they come back into the original essential unity. Now, getting back to your question that is fundamental, I think this is not commented on in the book explicitly, but is, in my view, is very clearly suggested by Ibn Arabi. He's responding to a main theological question in the Islamic tradition and other Abrahamic ways of thinking and expression in other close traditions, that is the name the same as the named? I hope I pronounce properly, it's not an easy one. Okay, and he would say yes and no, as his very, very, as his procedure often is the case, that he would answer yes and no, right? In a sense, the name is the same as the named when we refer to the primordial names, which are not known to people, are not at all manifested in creation, are not known and not even knowable. And in that level, they are the same as the name, as the named, sorry. But in the realm where the names are differentiated and articulated within spoken languages, in the realm of preferred words, then they are not the same. The name is not the same as the named. So he's answering this question that he would answer in different ways through the book. But he's also doing something more, I think. He's reminding us that the names we are dealing with as the 99 attributes in Arabic are only names of those primordial names, which remain unknown. So those names we know through revelation, through Hadith, through Quran, those are known to us in some extent, in different degrees. Some people might reach a level of essential realization of the names where they come to know all those 99. So they have a full restoration, harmonizing the diversity of divine attributes in their innermost being, in the secret of their heart. But for most people, there is a relative knowledge of some of those attributes or a number of attributes. Now, there is something very interesting in Ibn Arabi that is not emphasized by other authors, not even Sufis generally, which is that is the fact that in his approach of perceiving reality as a theophany, he would say that where we can perceive the effects of those primordial names is in the theophanic process, in the infinity of incessant, theophanies that are manifesting in front of us and that appear as theophanies if we have the experience of perceiving them as such through unveiling. So we might be blinded to that perception, but if it happens that we perceive that whatever is manifesting is in fact the theophany, that theophany is in fact the effect of a particular primordial name. Now, he would come to say otherwise, that divine names ultimately are infinite. They are endless, countless. Because from some perspective, since all beings in existence are the manifestation of a divine creative world, in a sense, all of them are from a certain respect and within the scope of a theophanic perception, divine names. So from that respect, there are nothing but divine names manifesting their effects in all the places of manifestation, the loci of manifestation. Two perspectives: the infinite, endless procession of names manifesting in all existence, and the other thing, those primordial names that do not manifest at all. So he's saying something very important. He's also saying that he will focus on the commentary on the Arabic names of the names. But he's also suggesting that human communities, human individuals in any other human context through history, in any conceivable place and time, are also dealing with the divine names and their effects. So primordial names are there for in God knowledge, but their effects manifesting in the articulation of an infinite number of divine names in all possible, imaginable, conceivable languages are also can also be seen as divine names. This is very important. I think this is related also to his approach to the science of letters. When in chapter 2 of Futuhat he's dealing with the letters, he will approach the whole ontology, the whole existence through the symbols of the Arabic alphabet. And he's completely focused on that, and he does not need to be comparing or going to other languages or whatever, because through this particular revelation he receives in the and the presence of the Quran in which he is immersed, he can approach in this language of numbers and Arabic letters, he can approach the universe of possibilities and relationships. But he is also suggesting that the most eminent master, or a most eminent master of this science, is Jesus, is Isa. And Isa was not speaking in Arabic, so or Moses was a big he was much wiser magician than those Egyptian magicians that ultimately surrendered to his Lord and became Muslims with him, because what he's suggesting is that this science of letters is not privative of the Arabic language. It's a universal science. So it is ultimately, the science of numbers is very clear in that respect. As the numbers are universal, independently of any language, independently of any serial of numbers, you are counted as a basic series of numbers. Independently, those are perceived as a universal language. The same happens with the primordial names. They are essentially a universal matrix for all possible concrete manifestations. So he's also suggesting implicitly, and I think this is very relevant, that through teaching us how to interpret and realize and approach the divine names as revealed within the Quranic tradition, at the same time, he's teaching us how to deal with the infinity of names revealed endlessly in the book of creation, in all respects. So I think we also should approach the book in that sense. It's not only getting familiar with the Islamic understanding and Sufi understanding of the Arabic names, but we are getting familiar with a way of traveling in interpreting the book as of endless theophanies that is our life and its existence.
Thank you. No, I think that clarifies the question a lot, and also relates to what you were saying earlier about the title of the book, the Kashf al-Ma'na, as unveiling. So if it's unveiling the meaning, that presumably means that there is a form whose meaning is constantly being unveiled. So one can relate to the names in the same way, I think. Can I ask you just to say something about the second part of the book and the second part of the translation that you did? Because you've translated a particular section from the Futuhat. We called it the summary in English. Could you describe this summary for those who haven't managed to delve into it yet, and perhaps give us an insight into why you included this section, which is a very special section within the great chapter at the end of the Futuhat on the divine names? So that's
yes, the question. Thank you. Yes, you are right that there is also this second commentary that is more connected to the dimension of what we have called tahakkuk, because in fact in this part Ibn Arabi would say he is Allah in that respect, he is whatever other name, because he would approach mainly an essential meaning in the understanding of the names. This comes at the end of this very long section, very long chapter 558 of Futuhat, is by itself one of the longest commentaries on the names. I haven't compared the length to Ibn Rajan's in terms of how many words, let's say, but it's really huge, a huge commentary. In the same way we were commenting, it is extremely original, it's very inspiring and enriching. Is placed there very close to the end, to the closure of the Futuhat with clear intention. And this final summary, although it is not named like that, but in a sense is a presence that gathers all those names together in a synthesis, in a sense. And this, first of all, I did choose that because it was more translatable, I could face it. of the lengthy chapter, I have been translated eventually one section, the other refer to that or the other name, but this would be a major work. Well, we will have a version by Eric Winkel. I don't know whether it is already available. I don't think so, but it will soon be available. But as it happens with Ibn Arabi's texts, those texts are always suitable for endless translations and approaches, because there are layers, levels of meaning that you can always comment on and discover. And this can be really astonishing. as you, Stephen, and me, we are experiencing in working with the poems on the letters at the beginning of Futuhat, and discovering that we can not stop commenting on things we find out from three lines, right? Well, that's the case for any writing of the master. And so to face that long chapter was a task beyond my capacity at the moment. Who knows, maybe one day that happens, that I face it again and do some Spanish version of it, because it is. I also wanted to work with a main text on indirectly on the divine names, and also on the Quran, as is always the case in Ibn Arabi, which is the Kitab al-Abadila. And I did work on the structure, on the text, but not as deeply as I would like one day, hopefully. So many things to do when you approach Ibn Arabi, and it's passionating, but every text demands a lot of concentration, attention, and time. And well, one thing that is very interesting of this summary is that it seems to be deeply connected to the name Huwa. So it's like he's, in summary, referring to the fact that he is Allah, he is Rahman, etc. The 99 names following the same list of Al-Walid, but with a slight differences and nuances here and there too, that I will not comment on now.
Yeah, the focus on the Huwa is very interesting. Maybe somebody will pick it up in the questions. I just wanted to ask you, because you've touched on it a little bit.
Because
I wanted to ask you about translating Ibn Arabi. It's always a tough task. Can you go back in your mind and share anything about the challenges of particularly translating this book for you? And what would make this book an essential read? Because you've done a lot of work to bring this book into a European language and then into English. What problems did you face in the translation? And if you can still remember them?
Yes, of course. Well, first of all, when you start getting acquainted with Ibn Arabi, if it was not for previous wonderful research on the domain, you would feel completely unable. So thanks to all the predecessors in translation and studying and approaching the structures and hermeneutical procedures of the master, otherwise I would have been completely lost. But with all this background, it was a great experience to have to choose that particular work, because, as I said, you would be working on many keys of so many subjects. In a way, it's an inclusive. Well, that happens with many writings of the Sheikh, but in a sense, you can say that it's an inclusive work, because starting with Al-Ism Al-Jamia, the inclusive name Allah, that would contain, in fact, the properties, the meanings of all the other names, then you would have a rain of stars of all major meanings that you would find otherwise in different places in Ibn Arabi's works. So that's a very rich experience when reading that book. It is particularly meaningful because it is a central topic of Sufism. First of all, the practice of dhikr itself as an experiential focus that is essential to the experience of the path, of precisely being progressively characterized by those presences, as Ibn Arabi calls, especially in Futuhadis, the different names, the presence of that particular name. And then, so being an introduction to the multiplicity of aspects of the divine is permanently a reminder of essential unity of that diversity. So it's a very important book in terms of getting this sense that you are recognizing the singularity, the specificity, the particular characteristics of an attribute, while been shown how it relates to its essential unity. And that's a main topic in Ibn Arabi. We find it in other authors such as Ibn Hasi, for example. And is the fact that from one respect, the names are manifestations of aspects in the divine, but from another point of view, all the names are names of the same reality. In that sense, it's not a term I would use in the book because it's just to let people understand easily. In a sense, they are all synonym. It's just your particular perspective where you're considering a name shows the specificity of certain meanings, but all of them refer to the single meaning. That's one of the important, one aspect of the importance of the singular in the title, is that in fact the meaning, the ultimate meaning, which is inclusive, which is absolute, makes that all those attributes that are all attributes of the one come to be, in terms of the primordial names, they come to be synonymous. So at the same time, you are having this experience of recognizing and respecting the statute of difference in all as possible aspects of manifestation, including opposites. In another sense, you are always guided to realize the ultimate meaning of unity that that each attribute implies. And so it's a great experience, and it's a great expression of the central idea of Tawhid within the Sufi tradition, right? So, and also the emphasis on the tahalluk, on the fact that all those attributes are to be realized within human experience, have to be actualized. This ihsa conceived as a qualitative actualization of the creative possibilities of the names as reflected in the human nature of as the mirror of the divine. And this is also a very central experience, is that in order to participate of the potential of the perfect human being present in every human nature, then you have to go through the degrees, through the stations, because also the tahalluk is considered an state, is also seen from the perspective of being the expression of a maqam. Sometimes in the book, Ibn Arabi says, I realize I was characterized by this particular, and he describes this experience of this concrete characterization as a maqam, as an station in his particular personal path. So it's an invitation to be open to our inner multiplicity and to the fact that all these possible experiences of our multiplicity all are pointers to their essential unity. So a very good companion for one's inner path of contemplation. Yes.
A tremendous companion. Thank you ever so much, Pablo. I'm going to turn now and invite our other guest up. Our panelist, Michael Sells, who is also well known, I think, to everybody here, but let me just give him a little bit of an introduction. He, because both of you are actually honorary fellows of the Muhyiddin Ibn Arabi Society, so you've been supporting the society's work for a very long time. Michael is the Barrows Professor Emeritus of the History and Literature of Islam at the University of Chicago. Very well-known author and translator, especially on the Quran and Islamic love poetry, Arabic Sufi poetry, and Ibn Arabi's Tarjuman, his translation recently of The Translator of Desires, masterful work. And currently speaking to us from Durham in North Carolina. So we are in three different places, all being able to be brought together. Michael, I wanted to ask you, apart from unmuting yourself, to give us an appraisal of this new book, if you would, from your point of view?
Thank you so much, Stephen, and thank you, Pablo, and to everybody here in the audience. It's a pleasure to have this conversation. In offering kind of some comments on the book, I think it would be helpful for me to use an example, because through the example, I can attempt to illustrate what I think are the high scholar standards of scholarship in the edited text and in the translation. It's not easy, of course, as we all know, to translate Ibn Arabi's texts, which are elusive and at the same time, in their own way, extremely rigorous. The translation, which has gone through Spanish, but also the English translation, as explained in the introduction, was not simply a direct translation from the Spanish, but went back to the Arabic text. And I can only say I find it breathtaking in the clarity and readability with which this very complex text has been presented. So let me move to the example I wanted to give, which is, for those of you who might have your book with you, I'll choose the name number 15 in the list, El Ghaffar, and that is on page 70. And I'll just go through and try to, in going through this very briefly, talk about the qualities of the volume. So this is, I'll be quoting from it. This is El Ghaffar, he who veils in grace, or the protector, the coverer. And as Pablo notes in the note, the first note, and every one of these notes, it's just right. The notes are extremely helpful in reading, but they don't overwhelm with irrelevant information. And the information they give really deepens the text in many ways. So El Ghaffar, El Satar, the one who covers. So in the dependents, you need this name in order that he may cover you with a protective veil that preserves you from everlasting misery. And then in the second one, Tahakkuk, in consideration of giving existence to created beings, the name El Ghaffar is the means by which God protects and veils them from having their lifeblood and individual I entities, the word is I-N, annihilated by the glorious splendors of his face. And of course, in each of these, here's footnote 4, unpacking the illusion in which God has 70 veils of light. If these veils were drawn aside, the glories of his face, subhat wajhihi, would annihilate every being that saw it. That's a hadith that's attested in some of the major hadith collections. He may descend upon each and every one of them a protective veil that keeps their existence from harm. Then in Tahalluk, and I often find this third section to be, they're longer, they tend to be longer and much thicker in the kind of moves or meditative moves that the reader needs, you know, or that the reader is invited into and given through this text. So here's Tahalluk characterization. This is, on the one hand, similar to realization. It also consists in you deliberately concealing from others what you would wish to be hidden from yourself. There are statements in here that one could ponder for a long time. And I take that as part of the meditational aspect of the text. Conceal from others what you would wish to be hidden from yourself. In you protecting yourself from opposition and discord with the protective veil of conformity and concord, both externally and internally. And as a form of vicar, as a form of reminder to, in much more mundane terms, to stay away from quarrels and other things that will ultimately cause harm. And in you veiling your spiritual station in the realm where essential reality does not lead it to being unveiled. Now, this is the last part. This characterization is necessary in the final abode at the moment when he manifests himself in a form that is denied. Of course, this is a reference to the Hadith of Nawafil, the Hadith of extra legally required devotions. And it's explicated once again within the note. Its significance is shown. And this is the moment in the Hadith when at the final abode, all these images appear. And the statement is, let me just read it here from the note. Then God will appear before them in a different form to that which they recognize, and he will say, "Am I your Lord?" They will reply, "We take refuge from you with our Lord. We will stay here until our Lord comes. When he appears, we will recognize him." And of course, this is leads to all kinds of very close relationships with Ibn Arabi's doctrine of the notion of the deity that is constantly transforming through forms. And then here's the conclusion. And you recognize that it is he who is revealed there, and where spiritual courtesy requires you to hide him in that abode and not to call anyone's attention to him, so that you are in conformity with what the real desires. So I wanted to give just a sense of the richness within each of these divine name sections, and to point out how what a gift it is to bring this extraordinary complex text. I believe, Pablo, in the introduction, you said that it was one of the earliest written texts of Ibn Arabi, if not the earliest. And then it just leaves me with a thought, a final thought. As I read through this text and think about the culture in which it emerged, and I was thinking about Abu Madyan a little bit too. Might we think of, and this is a question that Pablo may wish to address now, or if there's not time, I'll just leave it in the air. Can we think of this as emerging from perhaps a tradition of devotees to Abu Madyan, a tradition of meditating on the divine names in this way, perhaps not necessarily with the exact threefold division, and cultivation of meditational practices through vicar and through the act of reading, which, as Pablo said, even as we read this, it forms a meditation in which we are no longer passive readers, but the assumption of the text is that it could be transformative in some way. And that's my final observation, is to think about how this text, this kind of meditation, was percolating before Ibn Arabi wrote it up in this extraordinary way. And just to note how the first name, Allah, ends with a rather striking claim at the end, that those who are modeled on the name Allah, those who are reach characterization, are able to know when any seeker prays to God, to Allah, they're able to know which of the divine names that particular seeker is approaching Allah through without the speaker saying that name. And so that kind of a final thought on the psychology involved, the teaching psychology involved, the intensity of the meditations on the divine names to where we would arrive with a master having this kind of deep determination of the exact station of each of his or her students. So thank you very much. Those are my observations. Congratulations to everyone who put this volume through. And it's a pleasure to welcome this volume and the decades of scholarship, the various translations it's gone through to where we have it here before us.
Thank you so much, dear Michael. It's really joyful to be here with you. It's a real honor because, as I was referring to those who were working on Ibn Arabi and similar matters before me, you were always in my mind with your language of unsaying and others of your writings when I was working on this particular book. And your way of approaching hermeneutics and translation was extremely meaningful to me. So thank you for all your way through in dealing with these matters, but also for accompanying us today with such beautiful words. Thank you, Michael. Very, very nice. And you have been touching something very, very relevant, is that if I refer to that last commentary of you in the tahalluk of the name Allah, effectively, he would say that part of his characterization is to know from to which particular name the seeker is asking for at a particular state. So this gives also to an opening to other triadic approaches that are complementary. So I would like to refer the readers of this book to another fundamental book to understand this particular commentary you did, which is the Insha ad-Dawair, which has been published in English, in Italian, and French. So you can find the production of circles, I think, is in English. La production de cercles in French. So in this particular book, Ibn Arabi introduces us to what I have been called a psychosophy, which is a kind of the approach, how you deal with the science of the soul related to the science of the names, by which the knower, who is in that respect the perfect knower, would be the one who has been characterized by this inclusive knowledge of the name Allah. So this knowledgeable person can see what name is manifesting, is ruling upon three domains. He can see what is the name ruling, the name that is predominating upon the state of the person he is facing, he is relating to, but he can also distinguish that from the name that is ruling his actual maqam, his actual spiritual station. And it is different from a deeper level, which is the name that governs his innermost heart, his sir, his secret, which is particularly connected to the lord of this particular, the privative face of this servant with his lord. So three levels, the state, the station, and the secret of the heart, that can be approached in three levels, because Ibn Arabi says in the Insha, he says every name has not just one meaning, but he can be understood from at least three presences. He can be understood as a name of the essence. He can be understood as a name of the attribute it entails, a name of attribute, so as a quality, and it can be understood as a name of action. So another triad. So now multiply. If we take each name in those three presences and we can appreciate from the three perspectives of Ta'alluq, realization and characterization, and we see and we learn and become receptive to perceiving how those presences manifest in the state and the station and the secret of the person, if we multiply, we get to some 2,600 and something possibilities already with these triadic interactive dimensions. So just to say that it is a very rich structural background that he is providing to us as the basis for actualizing contemplations and letting us perceive what is happening in those interior levels corresponding to the hallowed, the state of the moment, the more stable station we might be experiencing during a time, or the nature of our inner secret. So a very rich offering, and the, let's say that this Kashf al-Ma'na, this book, is the key to approach those different meanings. So when commenting, you will realize that the name is not translated in one way. And this is connected to what Steve was asking, and I didn't answer, and to all your experience, Michael, as a most astonishing translator from whom I learned so much, and to the questions of translating in Arabic. So every name has to be translated according to his multiple understandings in different textual experiences and inspirations, and according, of course, to what he is dealing with in the particular chapter. But this is open to, as I suggested, to different layers. I give you an example. When he's dealing with the name Al-Hafidh, the preserver, he would make an interesting observation. He says the letter Ha, which is the letter of Huwa, this is the letter symbolizing the itseity, the supreme identity, the Huwiyya, the Hines, we used to translate now. So this letter Ha preserves itself, so has got the attribute of Al-Hafidh, of the one who preserves, and preserves the Kaun, preserves the cosmos, preserves existence. Generated being. And that's it. He says that, okay? Then you need time, you need to read all around what he writes elsewhere and to get familiar with different of his approaches to understand that he's, by saying so, he's implying so many things. First of all, I realize now in this book, and I didn't know at the time of the Spanish version, the value of the name Hafidh is 25. So this precisely includes the value of the letter Ha and the letter Kaf. So the letter Ha is the 5. And the 5 has got a numerical property, is that multiplying 5 by itself, always will give a result of 5. But not only will preserve the 5 at the end of the whatever the result comes later, but also will preserve the 2 before him. For example, 5 multiplied by 5 is 25. 25 by 25, 125. So 25 is preserved endlessly like that. It's an arithmetic rule, okay? So the kaf of count of existence, the letter kaf that represents existence, has this value 20. So suddenly, with a little sentence, he is introducing us to a different approach in understanding the names that is subtly present there, discreetly. He's not emphasizing that. Two or three places in the book are explicit, but otherwise we have to find within the text, and this is quite passionate, this other language underlying the explicit language, right? So that so that we see this relationship of the huwiya to existence, of the he-ness to existence in these numerical properties, right? And so one more dimension to contemplate the name, the Al-Hafidh. And so how do you translate that? You have to translate it in a way that, of course, respecting the text, the explanation that will come, but then you have to take very much into account the meanings, the essential meaning, the original meanings of the lexical root of the name. This is something permanent when translating in Arabic in particular. This is general for Arabic language, but in particular for those authors, and Nahrawi is the supreme master in that respect, that are so conscious of the original images implicit in the Arabic roots. So you have to keep that in mind. For example, in the text related to Ghaffar that Michael read to us, the fact that Ghaffara is not only is as a derivation is to forgive, but originally is to cover. So this original image of covering with a veil is the way in which Ibn Arabi would approach the meaning of this particular kind of forgiveness. Okay, so his approach is full of subtleties related to the marvel of Arabic language itself, because of all the interconnections and the original imaginary kept by the Arabic lexical roots. And this is one level, but then you have to take into account the alphanumeric level, and you have to take into account, as Michael was suggesting in his commentaries, all the tradition of Hadith and Quran that always interreference here and there, that make the text very, very rich and very polyvalent, so that it's really like every passage is a place for contemplation of this, of the interaction of these many possibilities of meaning. It does not mean, it is not, in a sense, it's not a particularly difficult book. In a sense, it's very explicative. It's a book of, let's say, definitions, and aims to be clear and accessible. But this is a first explicit level. Then you have to go farther and deeper and layer under layer to really extract all the conscious levels of meaning that Ibn Arabi is always offering to us when he writes something. His texts are never plain. His writing never means just something, but is a very fertile, rich, polyvalent experience, opening doors of interactive meanings, right? So his idea that that existence is recreated, that a creation is always a new creation at every instant, at every breath, is something we have to keep in mind when we read him. And of course, his hermeneutics of the Quran are deeply connected to that. When whether we read the Quran as he does, or whether we read his books, we have to understand that reading Ibn Arabi, we have to apply his own hermeneutical procedures. Michael, I learned it a lot about all these things in your writings. Would you please give us a feedback of what I'm commenting on, the matter of translation that Steve was asking for, your own experience?
Certainly, what I find about Ibn Arabi's texts is they have often a kind of a programmatic cover. So if one takes the Seth chapter of Fusus al-Hikam, for example, it's talking about various kinds of prayer, and it sets out there are two kinds of this aspect of prayer. Each of these two kinds has two kinds. Each of these two kinds has two kinds. And at the same time, it's putting in multiple resonances, and at some point it shifts to where we as readers are required to move out of the the diagram and move into another mode of reading and thinking. And of course, to translate all of that, to keep the extraordinary, the distinctive mode of language that Ibn Arabi applies with its multiple cross links across within the particular passage, and as you meant, across his other works, is a challenge that I think of as another form of contemplating the issues that Ibn Arabi spoke about. So even however we translate, however much we're able to bring across in a decent way, it engages us with this extremely rich world, which, as you mentioned, in terms of names, it's already a rich world with 100 minus one. But as you point out, the richness in Ibn Arabi is expanded as we read. And so it's never ending, really. I can only say that can only be grateful for the extraordinary work that's been done in the last five decades, a lot of it with the support of the Ibn Arabi Society, in bringing translations of Ibn Arabi, editing the texts. I don't think 50 years ago one would have thought that we might be here with this array of superb new translations coming out with the support of Anka and the society, excuse me. I'm having trouble with the banal world when I'm talking about how well, you know, the banal world of getting names right on the human level, when I'm talking about these remarkable body of work that's come out. So forgive my halting expression. But just to mention a couple, The Secrets of the Voyaging, another one, The Tree and the Four Birds. What's the title of that?
Universal Tree and the Four Birds.
Yeah, just to mention two more, and to read across them. So if one reads this work translated by Pablo and these other two works, one sees such an astonishing range of different kinds of discourse, all that are interiorly tied together, and yet with different emphasis on analytical reason, imagination, often with poetry and prose. The prose is often very poetic sometimes. And then this major work by Eric Winkle. I've had a chance to read the first volume and the work he's done in bringing that first chapter of Ibn Arabi to us it fits in with this progress.
Maybe I can move very quickly. I know we're beginning to run out of time, but let me just bring your attention to what's happened in the Q&A function. I think actually we've addressed quite a lot of it, but some of them are very simple to respond to. The first one says, what do you think is meant by taught in the context of Adam was taught the names? Does it mean merely mentioning and counting them, or kashf of their meaning as well? I won't read the rest of it, but I think we've covered that to quite a large degree in a lot of ways, because As you both pointed out, the form that we know, whether it's the form of the names, the form of the Quran, the form of hadith, the form of tradition, etc., mentioning it is one level, but there are deeper levels that the work of Ibn Arabi is constantly engaging us to, pushing us towards the meaning. And one of the aspects of this book is Kashf al-Ma'na, the unveiling of the meaning. So it is always kind of pointing towards, I think you put it earlier, Pablo, as saying, you know, there is a multiplicity of experiences of multiple theophanies but all of it is pointing us towards the essential unity. That's the point of it. It's not to get lost in the diversity, but actually to always return us in different ways to the same one who is revealing himself. So that's, I'm sorry, I've answered on your behalf, but I hope you don't mind. I want to get through the questions. Is the Arabic text included side by side in the hardcover edition? The answer is yes. Sorry, not side by side, but it's included at the end of the book. It was technically too complex to put it alongside. The English version, will it be released as a Kindle EPUB Mobi version? It already is released as an EPUB version. You'll find it on the Anchor website. And three, four more questions. Is it possible to consider the names also as joined up? Twos, threes, more, or even endlessly, as multi-compounds, all linked with the divine love revealing itself in plurality in an instant, that is, not only in one quality. Pablo, do you have anything to add to that? Can we think of these names as linked to each other in some way, in twos, in threes, in formats?
Yes, yes, certainly so. And we see, for example, in very often comments on names that are related in the same sentence in the Quran, appearing together in triads, couples, whatever, and everything manifesting in revelation, whether it is in the Quran itself or in existence, is meaningful to him as a pointer towards the meaning. So, yes, in a sense, all the time, endless names manifest their effects in any particular moment or situation or state. But the emphasis in the Akbarian perspective is that one of them becomes predominating, al-Hakim, the ruler of the situation of the state. So that when we face ourselves in the mirror, or we face a particular situation, what becomes self-evident is one particular attribute that is ruling the properties of the ensemble of attributes manifesting. So we say, oh, this situation is such and such, and we see something in particular because it's the ruler. Okay, he in Arabic calls that al-ism al-ghalib or al-ism al-hakim. So this particular fact that a particular attribute points out in a situation as the more meaningful for that particular breath. That's quite a common psychological experience, and is a way to approach. But certainly, at any moment, endless attributes are manifesting their effects in any possible situation, as we can easily conceive. Sometimes there is a predominant name that is very clear. Sometimes they may appear in a relation of a couple of them or a triadic relation. So yes, it's a very good observation. The matter is not only with names one by one, but it can be the case that we face a series of names interacting, appearing, manifesting their effects together in our consciousness, in our perception.
Another question, can you please clarify how all the 99 names are synonymous, because some may even appear as antonyms, like Al-Mu'izz, the honor giver, and Al-Mudhil, the humiliator, and so on. So there are these oppositions.
Yes.
How is it
that... This is the matter... Oh, sorry, anything else?
How is it that these are synonymous? In what sense are they synonymous?
Well, in one sense, synonymy do not exist, because every manifestation is singular and cannot be repeated. So at every divine breath, at every instant, creation appears in a new way. Every detail of creation appears in a new way that will never repeat. So in that sense, the way in which the names manifest their effects, appear as an endless procession of a renewal of meanings. So, in a sense, there is no synonymy at all. It's an infinite variety of possibilities, because this is the richness, the jewel of divine creativity. But from the perspective of essential unity, and those primordial names, the differentiation in the realm of multiplicity becomes, let's say, extinguished within the presence of the single meanings, because all those names, what they point towards is to him, and he is one, and it's one reality, and all those are his names, not the names of somebody else. So there is being only one, all the names come to mean he, and he is the same meaning for all, right? So the he-ness is permeating the infinite variety of manifestations of the names. So Theophany is always new. And this is connected to this hadith in the presence in the other life, when God manifests in a form and then another, and people do not recognize those forms, those theophanies that are theophanies of the primordial names, and they are lost. But this is not our Lord. They don't see that it's always He. So in that sense, all pointers towards the meaning are synonymous, because whatever their apparent difference might be in the realm of multiple manifestation, they remain essentially one.
I think in a way that answers the next question, which is the mention of the primordial names, which you referred to, another way of talking about the Ayan al-Thabita, or are you talking about the so-called leader names, you know, things like Hay, Alim, and so on? I think you've answered it in a way by saying that there's an infinite, countless expression of these primordial names, and what we know at this level as names are simply the effects of that. But at the level of the primordial names, they are the expression of the unity itself. They're not actually different. I'm summarizing something you said, because I wanted to get to the very last question, which in a way is on the same topic. 100 minus 1 is 99. 99 plus 1 relates to ultimate unity. Can that also be seen as referring to unity experienced by a person who realizes all the divine names?
Very much so. So the 100 in contrast with the sample 1, that would immediately mean essential oneness. The 100 would imply the realization of oneness within multiplicity. So yes, very much well expressed, I would say.
Well, I think that brings us to all the questions that we've had. It remains simply to thank you so much, both Pablo and Michael, for being so generous with your time, and to thank all of you for attending. And just to say that, you know, the book is available on the Anchor website, and that's a shameless plug. And I hope to see you all again.
Steve, before we say goodbye, yes, I would like to add my thanks to the Anchor Publishing House that you represent. And I would say that although it is my name that appears as the translator into English, my version wouldn't have been possible without the enormous work by Marina Whiteman and by Steve Hirstenstein himself. As an editor, you have been really caring of every detail, working so much in the final presentation of the book. So thank you. Thank you very much for accompanying this process so closely and giving so much to the final English language and to the and cleaning the book of many unnecessary things, so that it would become
We managed to get rid of some of the things associated with your PhD, you mean?
Exactly. It is free of PhD taste. Thank you so much. And thank you to everybody here for accompanying this presentation.